Like to welcome you here this morning and tell you that I'm glad that you're with us. I guess I'm speaking right now to the visitors primarily. If you don't come here often, or this might be the first time or the second time you've been here, I sure hope that you get a sense of what this group's really all about. We're people that are no different than you. We have the same kind of struggles and life as you, but we believe that there's a God above that sent his son to die for us, and we love him so much because of that, and we're striving to attain to all the promises that he gave through that son, that we could be like him and be with him, and that the world could be better around us because God would change us into his image. We're just trying to be Christians here. That's it. Nothing more to it than that. And so we're glad that you're here to check out what's going on in this place. If you would take out your Bibles and turn to 2 Peter. I'm not going to do a long introduction today to this series that most of you are pretty familiar with. Since the beginning of the year, we've been looking here at this text in 2 Peter chapter 1, where we have this list of virtues. It's a fairly famous passage where Peter begins to talk about adding to our faith certain things. And we've made the observation already this year that it's obvious that Peter didn't believe that faith in and of itself, by itself, was all in all what Christianity was about. That there were things to be added to faith and things to supply in that faith that really were in the pursuit of the real goal of faith, which is to partake in the divine nature, to be with God, to be made in his, or renewed to the image of the one who created us, and that we would really have the attitude and character of the Father that we love. You know, I was reading this text again this week, and something jumped out at me. Look at chapter 1, verse 19. Chapter 1, verse 19 says, "So we have the prophetic word made more sure, to which you do well to pay attention, as to a lamp shining in a dark place, until the day dawns and the morning star arises in your hearts." What does that verse mean? The first part of that verse where he says, we have the prophetic word made more sure. We made point of this at the beginning of the year. The first part of this chapter seems ridiculous. It seems like a fairy tale. It seems like all the other stories that have been spun by mankind that say that there's a Neverland at the end of your flight tonight, or there's, you know, a Wonderland down a rabbit hole, or all of the fantasies that men have come up with that you can be something great or different. And Peter knows that what he says about being partakers of the divine nature sounds that way. And I think that's why he says in verse 16, we did not follow cleverly devised tales about this. This is something that we saw and heard with our own eyes on the Mount of Transfiguration, he talks about. And then in verse 19, he says, we have this prophetic word. What's the prophetic word? That you can be partakers of the divine nature. That you have all things that pertain to life and godliness in the message from God. I'm sure of this, Peter says. But I want you to notice the instruction in the verse. It says, we would do well to pay attention to this. To give real attention to these words in these verses and the ideas of this text until a time comes. And I want you to notice what it says in verse 19 about how long we should pay attention to these things. It says, until the day dawns and the morning star arises in your hearts. What does that mean? I think this crowd of people probably are in a number of different places individually. There are some of you that are here because somebody made you come. There are some of you that are here because you're longing so desperately to find hope and light and comfort. There are some of you that are here because this verse has happened to you and I couldn't keep you away for anything to come worship God. You know what's great when I see this happen is look at the end of verse 19. When the day comes for somebody that the morning star arises in their heart when the day dawns for them. And I believe that's talking about Jesus. Revelation 22, Jesus calls himself the morning star. I think what Peter's saying here is a lot like what Paul said to some of the people he wrote to, that he labored with birth pains until Christ was formed in those people, until inside of somebody there was a spark, a moment where they got it and they understood the point and they fell so in love with God that Jesus was in their heart and they wanted to be like him more than anything else. That's what this year is about. And I don't know where you are in this. I don't know if the lights come on. I don't know if the morning star has arisen in your heart. But if it hasn't, then I'm going to suggest to do the same thing. Keep paying attention to this until it does. Keep thinking about these ideas and putting them into your life and striving to reach these ideals, because one day it'll hit you how grand and how glorious it is that God promises us these things. And for those of us that the morning star has arisen in our heart, I sure hope that we're sharing that and excited about it and talking to people about things like faith and moral excellence and knowledge and self-control and perseverance and godliness, because those are the kinds of things you read Paul talking to people about in Acts, because Jesus had arisen in his heart and he reasoned with people about self-control and righteousness and the judgment to come, and he scared people like Felix with it. I hope you're talking about it. Today, we're going to talk about brotherly kindness. You know, I thought of a lot of different ways to do this sermon. I was working on it, and then Dave Barnes came and preached a sermon sort of like it on Tuesday night of the week. I wasn't here, and so I didn't hear it, so I could have just preached that same sort of thing, and you all would have said, "Did you just steal that from Dave Barnes?" I wasn't here that night. If you're looking on the board, you see the word Philadelphia up there. And many of you already know this, but some of you, this is going to be new to. In the Bible, the word for brotherly kindness or brotherly love is the word Philadelphia. You've heard, in fact, we live in a day where when you say Philadelphia, people think of the city, not this thing that we're talking about. It used to be that it was the other way around. Before there was a city of Philadelphia, people talked about brotherly love, and they knew the word Philadelphia. And then there was a city that was sort of made with the idea of this word. I did some research on the city. Never been there. I've always heard it called Philadelphia. That's what I've heard. So I don't know if that's right. But it was interesting to me that the idea of the city was from William Penn, after which Pennsylvania's legend says is named after him. He wanted to name it Sylvania, beautiful forest, beautiful sort of woods. But England wanted to honor him somehow, and so they named it Pennsylvania. But this city that he established, really, that was... it started as a charter and was really just a colony. But he wanted this city to be a place where people could worship God without fear of oppression. Dave Barnes did a lesson a couple weeks ago on sort of the religious heritage of our country and the spirit of the restoration movement that we come out of. And really, the way we come out of it is just that we have the same spirit as people like William Penn and others who understood that the oppression of the Church of England wasn't right. So he wanted a city where Quakers, which is where what he was, and anyone else could, in brotherly love, try to figure out what God wanted. So Philadelphia started that way. It's a great idea. Of course, God never meant for there to be a city on the planet like that. God created a kingdom that would encompass the whole earth like that. We are the Philadelphia of this community in a sense. But I want you to look at the word Philadelphia for a minute and really take heart to this familiar word that we call the city of brotherly love. But think about the words for a minute. The first part of the word comes from philos, or philos, or phileo. And usually we talk about phileo as like friendship love, but the word philos means something like friend, or to be fond of someone, a fondness for them. And then the second half of the word is adelphos, brother. So to be fond of brothers. I like Greek words. I like words. I don't know Greek, but I like learning about words. You know a lot of words like this, actually. You know the word philosophy. And philosophy means to be fond of what? Wisdom. In the Greek, it's philo. And I wrote these down so I could say them right. Sophos, where we get words like sophistry and other things. But philosophy, fond of wisdom. Philanthropist, that's in the Bible. Philanthropy is fond of anthropos, men, people, humanity. We have words that we don't really use, but you recognize some of them. Philotheos, or actually, let's flip it. It's both ways in the Bible. It's philotheos, or it's most excellent, Theophilus. Theophilus means, or philotheos means, to be fond of God. Philonexia, or xenos, to be fond of strangers. That's hospitality, philonexia. It's a really cool word. It's a cool idea. But here's the trick to this. If the word means to be fond of my brothers, I'm not going to make this too complicated. Is this even close to true for you? The people sitting in this room right now, can you say that you are fond of them? And I don't mean, can you say you are fond of like 10 of them, or a couple of them that you like their jokes and you enjoy their company and you like the things they do and they're your friends? I mean, can you say that you are fond of everyone? Honest. Be honest. And I know some of you can't do that because some of you have told me about how you can't do that with some people. You just can't figure out how to be fond of that one that never talks, never says anything, never shows you any respect. You've talked about the people that you can't be fond of because they say too much and never stop talking. You talk about the people that you can't be fond of, and now I'll tell you my things for all the same reasons. There's some people I don't get. There are some people I don't understand. There are some people that I think are rude. There are some people that I think could do better. There are some people that could do all kinds of things. But I'll tell you what, I'm not always fond of people. And so I've got my friends. Can I tell you that I think this group does a better job than a lot of other places I've seen? Which means very little because we don't measure ourselves by ourselves. We don't measure ourselves by others. We measure ourselves by the standard that God sets forth. Now, here's my point in this kind of little exercise. Those people that you're not so fond of, and you've got all your reasons for why you're not fond of them. How do you suppose God feels about them? This is an issue of the divine nature, isn't it? Which is interesting because the divine nature, what does that have to do with brethren? What does that have to do with God-loving brothers? God's not brothers to, we're not brothers to God, are we? He's our creator. What is this business about God being fond of us as brothers? Except that's exactly what the Bible teaches, that when God became flesh and dwelt among us, He became our brother. He loves us like brethren. He calls us brethren, Hebrews chapter 2. And I'll tell you what, that person that I'm not fond of sitting across the building from me, God is. Do you suppose that God is fond of them because God just likes all the hobbies that they like? Or that they just sort of always rub Him the right way with the way they talk and the jokes they make and the way they're awkward or not so awkward? Do you think it's just that God looks down on the merit of those personal characteristics and says, yep, he's pretty cool? Anybody have kids that you struggle with like that? Don't raise your hand. Although all your kids sit up front, so maybe you could. But you have kids that you sort of tend to get more than other kids. Do you struggle ever with fondness for the others? You ever said anything like this? I love you, but I'm really not your friend right now. Or I love you, but I don't really like you very much. Now, I'll tell you what. I had a conversation when I was younger with an old man. He'd been a Christian a really long time. And he heard me say something about this, that I was trying to learn how to be fond of everyone in the family of God. How I was trying to learn to like them and be friends with them. And that I thought that that was a biblical idea. He came up to me afterwards and he took me aside, very well-respected man. And he said, you know, Andy, you don't have to do that. You don't have to. All you really have to do is agape them. You don't have to be fond of them. And I watched this man after that. It never really occurred to me to watch him. But I'll tell you what, he was annoyed by everybody. Like, everyone said things wrong and weren't smart enough. And he didn't have any friends, really. A couple. He was seeking to justify himself is what he was doing. But does the Bible teach that we have to learn how to be fond of each other? I think it does, right here in this text. Now, the greatest of all the loves, of course, is the one we'll talk about next month with agape. And agape is the thing that will make brotherly love possible. Which is why agape needs to be added in or supplied to brotherly love. Because if I don't love God and seek what's best, then I'll never really understand loving people. I have at the bottom of the chart a few, just actually all the places the word Philadelphia is used. Romans 12:10, 1 Thessalonians 4:9, Hebrews 13:1, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 22, and here in 2 Peter 1:7. And there's a couple of other times where slightly different forms of it are used, but this is it. This is it. And I thought about showing you all of them. But I decided against that. You can look at them yourself. I want to show you a couple that I think are really important, though. Go back one book to 1 Peter and look at chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1. Since you have an obedience to the truth, purified your souls for a sincere Philadelphia. Fervently love one another from the heart. In this verse, Peter says some things that I think are shocking, actually, when you really think about it. Look at the verse again in chapter 1, verse 22. And notice that what God says through Peter is that when we obeyed the truth, and God purified our souls, there was a purpose in it. And you know what's interesting is that this could have said a lot of things. Since you have, in obedience to the truth, purified your souls for a clean conscience, or a godly life, or to go to heaven, or whatever you want to put down in that, notice what it says is the reason for my purification. for a sincere love of the brethren. That's part of the purpose of my regeneration, is that God would take me away from selfishness and living in the world like everybody else does. Loving those who love them. Doing good to those who do good to them. Even the tax collectors and the sinners do the same, Jesus said. But what you were purified to do and be, what we were meant to be in the family of God, was this. Fond of each other. Friends with each other. Family to each other. Now, there's a couple of words in this text that are interesting to me. Look at the verse again and notice the word, depending on your version, fervent. Fervently. Love one another fervently. And I'll tell you what, here's the goal, because you might be a little bit uncomfortable with all of this, thinking, you know, I love some people, sort of, but I certainly don't love all of the people. Get rid of the sort of and shoot for this ideal. Fervently. With fervor. Effervescent. Like you're really excited about being friends. You know what I think is hard about being young? I think it's hard for these guys. Because I was there once. I think it's really hard to learn to be friends with people you don't have a lot in common with, you think. It's hard to do that at school. It's hard for these kids, I think, maybe to come here and not always mesh. And the temptation is that, you know what, I'm just going to find friends elsewhere that I'm excited about somewhere else and just kind of do that thing. And I did that for a long time. And some of it was there weren't a lot of kids my age where I grew up. There just weren't people to be friends with, right? Until one day it occurred to me that I could be friends with people no matter how old they were. And in that little church where I grew up, I became really good friends with a really old lady named Nola Fleetwood. And Nola Fleetwood changed my life and changed my perspective. I became friends with kids who were younger than me. Matthew Booth and Melanie Welch and Keith Welch. There were gaps between us, but we were friends. And we didn't always do the same things. We didn't always like the same things, physically speaking, but you know what? We were sons of God. And we had that in common. Look at the verse again and notice another word besides fervently. It says a sincere love. Your version might say something different than sincere. And by the way, this is a heart issue because it says to love them from the heart. It's not just about doing a couple things from them, but in your heart, harboring some sort of ill will. It's from your heart trying to figure out how to love them. But look at the word sincere. I like the old King James version in this. It's unfeigned. It's not a word I use every day, unfeigned. Do you know what the word really is in Greek? Not like a hypocrite. Not like a hypocrite. Rob mentioned in the Wednesday night class that the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks a lot about hypocrisy. And hypocrisy was not a common way to describe people at that time as insincere. That really wasn't at the time. Jesus was sort of using it in a very forward way. Really what it meant in the time was an actor. You ever heard of a hippodrome? There's still hippodromes like in New York City. Hippodromes are where hypocrites take the stage. And this says, don't act like it. Don't feign it. It's not a play. You're not goofing around here. That you need to purify your soul, or your soul's been purified for a sincere love of the brethren. Unfeigned. You gotta take off the masks. You know what's so hard about taking off masks and learning to love each other is sometimes you have to sit down across the table from each other and look at each other and say, now look, I don't really know what to do here, but I'm struggling with this. We're not close. We don't really know one another. And maybe we don't have to know everyone great, but there's a problem here, and I've felt it for a long time. If you've never had a conversation like that, you probably are struggling with this. Because people who want to do this verse right have looked around and thought, you know what, there's something missing in some of my relationships, and I don't know why, so we need to sit down and talk about this. So I've had to sit down sometimes with people, and I've had people sit down with me and say, look, I've had trouble figuring out how to really get to know you, and we've got to figure this out. Look at chapter 3, verse 8 of 1 Peter. Chapter 3, verse 8. You'll notice that it's not on my chart here. 1 Peter 3, 8 is not Philadelphia. It's a slightly different form. I think it's like Philadelphus or something like that. But look at verse 8. To sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit. You know what you should do sometime is read everything before this in 1 Peter. And ask yourself this question. What in the world does all that stuff have to do with this summation? When he sums up and says, to sum up, I want all of you to be this way. Harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted. And he bookended it. He said it at the beginning in chapter 1 to purify your hearts for a sincere love of the brethren. And then he said it in chapter 3 to sum up. Now read the in-between stuff sometime. What does it mean to love my brethren? What does it mean to do it sincerely? And what you'll come away with is a very different take on brotherly love. Things you never thought meant that you love your brother, you'll see meant love your brother. John said in one of his letters that those that genuinely love the brethren, or if we want to know if we love the brethren, it says that we do what God says. If you love your brother, and the proof is, do you do what God says? That's a weird equation to me. But that's what Peter's going to say. Peter's going to say, if you love your brethren, then you need to see yourselves as priests of God, proclaiming His excellencies, not living in sin, doing what God wants you to do, and that's part of loving your brethren. That's the answer. Because you can't live wrong and do wrong and act wrong and not live for God's things and then sit around and act like everything's great. There's a lot of things like that in this text. I want to take you, though, back to Romans 12. And I want to end, well, sort of begin to draw our lesson to a close with this text. Romans chapter 12. Verse 10. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. I just want you to think about that verse, and then I'll sort of go out from that verse to the context. I don't know how to ask this, but how many of you feel like you are devoted to brotherly love? And it isn't actually that you're devoted to brotherly love. Look at the verse again. It's that you're devoted to one another in brotherly love. It's a little bit different. I know people that think they obey this verse because they're devoted to the idea of brotherly love. That's all they talk about. We gotta love our brothers, we gotta love our brothers, we gotta love our brothers. But if you really press a little bit deeper and find to see if the rest of that verse is true for them, that they are devoted to one another in brotherly love. That's different. Do you know the people in this group who are devoted to one another in brotherly love? Let's just drop all the stuff after the first part of the sentence. Do you know very many people, or do you know the people in here who are devoted? They're devoted. And you know them. Because you see them devoted. They're around. They're asking and sharing. If somebody was to measure your life, and you need to do this yourself, but if somebody was to do it, and this was the question for them, who is Andy Cantrell devoted to? What would be the answer? It used to be that people would have said, my brother would have said when I was a teenager, Andy Cantrell is devoted to his friends. I think he would have said that. I was always with him. I spent all my time with him. Except that my friends were ungodly and all kinds of different things. That was my devotion. You know, somebody might say that you're devoted to your family. That's great. By the way, being devoted to friends and being devoted to family are biblical ideas. But the Bible is going to teach that devotion for one another supersedes those. Did you know that? It's greater than those. Because one of these days, your family, whether it's a wife or a husband or kids or mom or dad or anything else, one of these days, that family may not be devoted to the Lord. I'll tell you what, one of the ways that Satan causes churches not to grow and things not to happen in the kingdom of God, he's convinced people that their own little personal kingdom at home within their walls is more important than the kingdom of God. He's convinced people, even through preaching that's a little bit off kilter, that devotion to your family on earth is more important than devotion to your family in the Lord. And it sounds really good, but it's not true. Devotion to one another. Look at the rest of the verse. Giving preference to one another in honor. I like the footnote of this. Outdo one another in showing honor. I know David Barnes says he really doesn't like competition, but this is one of those Bible verses where competition is encouraged. Get into a competition to see if you can outdo one another in honor. It sounds silly, doesn't it? You ever seen something like that happen? You first. No, you first. No, you first. No, you first. Like, what do you want to eat? No, where do you want to eat? Like, you're more important than me. You're more important than me. And it looks really silly. But I'll tell you what, that's awesome. That's so cool. When people's characters are so shaped that that's how they are with one another. And I understand that in the silliness of those conversations, somebody has to say, now look, just pick, would you? You got to go first. And that's why God teaches the other side of it, that when somebody honors you, accept it. When somebody prefers you, accept it. When somebody washes your feet, let them. Just next time, try to wash their feet first. That's the idea. How do you do it? How is this real? Go back up to verse 1 of chapter 12. Therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. How this is done is only done when people see themselves as a living sacrifice. You know, sacrifice was violent. It was violent. The slitting of throats and the cutting of arteries and the pouring out of blood and death. It hurt. And yet here we sit sometimes when we're annoyed with each other. And I couldn't possibly be friends with them because it just is so painful to be around them. Read verses 1 and 2 again. Living sacrifice. And here's a thought. Do you suppose it's any harder for me to learn to be fond of my brothers than it was for God to learn to be fond of us? I urge you by the mercies of God. That's the urge in verse 1. The mercies of God. What are the mercies of God? Go back and read chapter 5. That while we were yet enemies, Christ died for us. While we were helpless, that's when He did His work. He loved us when there was nothing fond about us. And then He turns around and says, now look, if you're going to be like me, if you're going to be partakers in my divine nature, then you love one another. Be fond of one another. And you know what? You can't think about that very long, but not be convicted by it. That God loved you. With all of your annoyance, with all of your mistakes, with all of your weakness, with all of your whatever, if you stand in front of God, He still is fond of you. And there ought not ever be another human ever in my life that stands in front of me that I can't learn to be fond of. I'm going to stop the lesson there, and I'll have more to say about this topic more sort of specifically and illustratively tonight. But I think this lays some things at your feet that are good to think about. You do well, we do well to think of these things until the dawn has broke, until the morning star has arisen in our heart, until we finally begin to understand what it means to be like Jesus Christ. And I sure hope that your time spent here this morning has helped you in that way. If we can help you in any way right now, we're going to sing a song that explores some of these themes. And we hope that you'll consider it. And if you need to come to the Lord or ask for our help, we'd love to invite you up front to do that. Please stand and sing.
How sweet, how heavenly is the sight when those that love the Lord